Hello, my name is Joshua Gilliland, attorney blogger on Bowtie Law. Today we are going to discuss the history of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure as they relate to their e-discovery amendments and the proposed amendments to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. This podcast is sponsored by NextPoint, and with me is Jason Krause, and Jason's going to help me and you understand the history of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure amendments on e-discovery. Jason, how are you today?
Great. Thanks for having me.
So educate us, please, on Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
Yeah. For those of us who've been following e-discovery for a long time, it's kind of weird and surprising that we're here again already, because the federal rules were amended just back in 2006 to account for electronic evidence in discovery. But if you've been following the industry for a while, I guess it's not that surprising that we're here again. It's just interesting that the process seems to be moving a lot faster this time. The last time it took years for lawyers to sort of admit to the problem, then accept the problem, and then finally address the problem before it finally got ratified. This time it seems like the train has pretty well left the station and is well on its way. Obviously, there's going to be changes yet to the proposed rules, but it seems like nothing's going to stop it from getting there. So I wanted to talk a little bit about exactly how it is we got to where we are and why it is that electronic evidence is still such a problem in litigation. I mean, you can go back as far as you want, but electronic evidence has been part of litigation. You can look at in the 80s in the Iran-Contra affair when Ali North's emails were a big part of the process, or the 1990s when during the Microsoft antitrust trial when lawyers David Boies kept handing Bill Gates printouts of his emails and making Bill Gates very annoyed and flustered on the stand. But the real beginning for most of us, I think, is in the early 2000s. I was just starting as a technology reporter at the ABA Journal, and I kept getting assigned to write about this case out of the Southern District of New York. It was the Zubelake case, which a lot of people are familiar with. It was just a run-of-the-mill employment dispute case. This woman, Laura Zubelake, was suing her employer, UBS Warburg, for passing her over for promotions. And she asked for copies of emails that would attest to her claim. Warburg, UBS Warburg, for their part, they said, whoa, we can't give you those emails. They don't exist on servers or on computers anymore. They're only on backup tapes and in our storage space somewhere, and it would cost a lot of money for us to produce those for litigation. And in most cases, that probably would have been the end of it. The judge would have either ruled in favor of one party or the other and then moved on to the next matter. But the judge in this case was Judge Shira Shindlin, who most of us in the e-discovery space know very well. And she wrote a series of six decisions, hundreds of pages of dense balancing tests to determine whether or not it was worth the effort and the cost and the expense in the interest of justice to obtain these emails from the backup tapes for litigation. In the end, I believe she ruled largely in favor of Laura Zubelake, but her tests, these rulings sort of became the law of the land. Most jurisdictions sort of adopted her standards and used them, but it became clear very quickly that her rulings were very specific to backup tapes, and backup tapes are already outdated technology that few companies really rely on anymore, and that there needed to be rules that would allow for the discovery of electronic evidence, which is coming from all sorts of new sources now. You've got, you know, your iPhones, your mobile, your cloud applications, and we needed rules that were going to be able to account for all this data in trial. And so we got to the 2006 rules amendments, which were pretty good. They did a good job of creating sort of a very general framework for lawyers to work within. They tried to be not specific at all so that the rules wouldn't be overtaken by new technology and made obsolete. The most important change was probably the Rule 26F conference, the Meet and Confer conference, which is sort of mandated that lawyers get together at the start of a matter and that they exchange information and hammer out agreements regarding the discovery of electronic evidence. And this has probably helped head off a lot of ugly disputes. And there's been a few other important changes. But it's become clear over the years that the rules didn't quite answer all the questions. We still have parties getting sanctioned for failure to preserve electronic evidence. It's an incredibly rare phenomenon, but it does happen, and it's kind of thing that's it's bad enough. There have been multi-million dollar sanctions that it scared a lot of attorneys, and that it's clear that there needs to be a fix. There's a nice little anecdote I remember last year. Judge Shindlin was actually at an e-discovery conference in Georgetown, and she said to the crowd, she was disappointed that the Rules Committee did not have the courage or the vision to write a rule on preservation, which, you know, is an offhanded comment from a federal judge, you know, no big deal at a conference, except that she was sitting next to Paul Grimm, Judge Paul Grimm at the time, who is the chairman of the committee that's writing these rules, and she was basically saying to him that he had failed, in her estimation, to appropriately deal with the issues. So there's a lot of back and forth and controversy and a lot of things that need to be fixed. I think overall, though, the rules are the new rules, and I'll turn it over to you in a minute, Josh, to let you dive in some detail. But I think the new rules, if applied properly, if the judges do what the rules say, have an opportunity to really remedy some of the core problems in e-discovery. Because, for example, there's the language on proportionality I wanted to read real quickly just says that parties may obtain discovery regarding any non-privileged matter that is relevant to any party's claim or defense and proportional to the needs of the case, considering the amount in controversy, the importance of the issues at stake in the action, the party's resources, the importance of the discovery in resolving the issues, and whether the burden or expense of the proposed discovery outweighs its likely benefit. So this, all right, is a very dense sentence, but it's a very important sentence because in litigation right now, the problem is that the cost of discovery in many cases is so great that it forces parties to settle or just decide not to go to trial because they're not going to be able to afford the discovery costs. So there's a lot of language in here that, if applied properly, could allow parties to more effectively manage the costs of discovery and hammer out early on exactly how much discovery is going to cost, how much discovery they can afford when they go into a matter. There was a recent case that I think you probably saw a lot of bloggers have been writing about, the Tampa Bay Water Commission recently lost a suit, but it was a suit that had been arbitrated. The arbitrator had initially put in place a settlement for about $30 million. In the end, the Tampa Bay Water Commission decided not to accept the arbitrator's decision and went to trial, and they lost and got $0. But the important thing is that at the close of the matter, when they were hammering out the cost sharing, Tampa Bay wound up having to pay over $3 million just for the cost of preserving and managing the electronic evidence in this case. And the total attorney's fees came to about $20 million. So we're talking about a $30 million case that had over $3 million in ESI, cost to manage ESI, and then $20 million in other related matters for a case that wound up being worth nothing. So unless we can find a way through these rules to control costs and to make e-discovery more affordable, we're probably going to be back here discussing new rules changes in another 5 years or whatever the matter is. But I so far I think that the language proposed, there's some reason to hope that they've solved some issues. I have some concerns about some other pieces, but I'll leave that to you to talk through in some detail.
Thank you, Jason, and I share your thoughts, and I appreciate the rule overview, as I'm sure others do as well, just for what's happened since 2003. Well, let's take a look at the proposed amendments. And I will bring up my slideshow and we will check these out. So the overview of the amendments to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. These are all proposed rules, so it's very important to stress everything I'm saying, add the word proposed in front of it, so that way no one thinks that these are actually in effect yet. They now just entered public comment on August 15th, and I encourage everyone to download it and read it and check it out from the U.S. Court's website and make comments. You know, think about this. How does this impact your practice? Do you agree with them or do you not agree with them? Check them out, think about it, and make public comments to help everyone in this rulemaking process. I am a Rule 1 hawk. Rule 1 is now incorporating elements of cooperation into its text, but it doesn't actually use the word cooperate because the rulemaking committee felt that that would invite secondary litigation where people would go to court and say, Your Honor, he's not playing nice with me in the sandbox. Well, we can't have that. We can't invite additional secondary litigation. So the modification to Rule 1 is these rules should be construed, administered, and employed by the court and the parties. That's the change. To secure the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of every action proceeding. I like this. I think this is a good thing to get people to talk about because the court and the parties should be concerned with how the case is litigated to determine the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of the proceedings. Rule 26 is the superhighway of e-discovery. There are several changes throughout of it. So one of the earliest is a reference to Rule 34, and that's under Rule 26D2, and it adds early discovery prior to the meet and confer. It's something we don't have now. If you want to get early discovery, you got to go to court, and you have to show good cause and jump through a bunch of hoops in order to get early discovery. Well, in this, somebody's been served, and what the proposed rule states, more than 21 days after the summons and complaint are served on any party, a request under Rule 34 may be delivered to that party by any other party and by that party to any plaintiff or to any other party that has been served. Interestingly, it is considered served at the first Rule 26F conference. And then, of course, there's a rule change in Rule 34B2A to reflect this as well. Now, the concern with this is this might cause additional early discovery and fighting prior to even the meet and confer taking place, and that's a bad thing. Because we're now, people are fighting about discovery before even the meet and confer takes place, which could be counter to Rule 1. On the flip side, it might help a lot if we get parties to get IT managers to sit down, and if they're being deposed about what's the data map, what technology is at issue here. And so there are good and bad elements to this one. I don't know where I will come down ultimately on it. I really want to think about this a little more and wonder if this is a good idea. But that was, this is interesting and it's worthy of discussion. Proportionality is written into the front end of Rule 26B1. This has been interesting because with litigation the last 7 years, a lot of parties were arguing proportionality wrong. Instead of arguing proportionality, they were arguing accessibility and undue burden, which is different than proportionality. Accessibility and undue burden deals with how you get the information. Where is it located and what do you have to do to go out and get it? Proportionality deals with the usefulness of it? Does it help the lawsuit move forward? Does it relate to the claims and defenses? So it's a different creature, and there are tons of cases where people were arguing undue burden when they should have been arguing proportionality. The text of the rule states that we're trying to limit the scope of discovery so that discovery must be proportional to the needs of the case, considering the amount in controversy, the importance of the issues at the stake in the action, the party's resources, the importance of the discovery in resolving the issues, and whether the burden or the expense of the proposed discovery outweighs its likely benefit. One argument that we don't need this is we already have a rule on proportionality. It should be working if people argued it. The counter to that is the rule's there, but they're not using it. And if we put it into the front end so that way we're trying to control this out of the gate, because for some reason lawyers don't read down a couple other sections to see that there's proportionality there, that this is going to try to solve the problem. I've listened to some other subject matter experts on e-discovery talk about this, and some are concerned this will actually cause more litigation because they will fight about what is actually proportional to the case, and it's inviting infighting. I don't think the courts would let that happen. I do think they would try to fight that as much as possible. But this is, again, this is something to think about. I mean, it could be a very good thing, or it could have some nasty, unintended consequences. And I haven't made up my mind yet. I don't know what public comments I will make on this, but I need to spend a lot of time thinking about it. There are more proposed changes under Rule 26b1. Discovery is now limited to matter that is relevant to any party's claim or defense. This is trying to control the floodgates, control fishing expeditions by being able to zero in on claims or defense. This makes targeted collections far more attractive as opposed to going out and mirror imaging everything that could be in sight that has a keyboard attached to it or a power outlet. And there is also a change dealing with the rules of evidence that are referenced in the Code of Civil Procedure. And the change would be information within the scope of discovery need not be admissible in evidence to be discoverable. Wonderful example of that is hearsay. That hearsay is not admissible unless you fall under an exception or it's non-hearsay. And so that's a wonderful example of something that could fall in the realm of it might not be admissible in trial, but it's still discoverable. Rule 26b2b. This has been a wonderful rule that I've cited many, many times in many blog posts over the last 7 years. Well, here's what the new version would look like if enacted. Responding party may state that it will produce copies of documents or of electronically stored information instead of permitting inspection. Production must then be completed no later than the time for inspection stated in the request or a later reasonable time stated in the response. The idea with this change is to avoid any confusion on whether or not something's going to be inspected or whether or not you're going to produce electronically stored information. I'm sure there are many situations where requesting parties have gone out and gone to Colos and physically inspected servers, and I'm sure that's happened. They probably don't want to do that. They probably actually just want a collection for what they need that relates to the subject matter of the lawsuits, things that go to the claims or defenses in the case. And that's the idea with this, is to state when you're going to go out and inspect something and when are you expecting just the production. I really do like the objection proposals under Rule 26b2c. And the change is an objection must state whether any responsive materials are being withheld on the basis of that objection. No more boilerplate objections leaving everybody confused. There are additional changes in the rules as well that don't necessarily relate to e-discovery, but they're still kind of the backbone of civil litigation. Depos. It's difficult to find any lawsuit without a deposition. Well, the new rules would limit the number of hours a deposition could be, and also reduce the number of depositions from 10 to 5, because there was evidence that most civil cases don't have more than 5 depos. Unless you're dealing with some monster litigation, and then you're going to have a discovery plan, and people are going to be agreeing to things. There would also be limits set on special interrogatories as well. Rule 34, the other heavy hitter in e-discovery. Rule 34B2B would require that the grounds for objecting to a request be stated with specificity. The language is borrowed right from Rule 34B4. And Rule 34B2C would require that an objection state whether any responsive materials are being withheld on the basis of that objection. We are used to situations where lawyers write a whole laundry list of objections. Well, if you're not producing something, say so. What's being withheld on the basis of that objection? Is this just a belt and suspenders approach because we're afraid and we don't want to inadvertently waive a privilege? So if something's there, you know, say so. And that would then, in theory, need to go right into your privilege log and why it's being withheld. So I think this is a good thing. Maybe it's just because I have an anal retentive nature on this sort of issue, but I think the objection modifications would be very good. So let's talk about sanctions and preservation, because they talked about this. Now, while they don't outright get into the weeds of the duty to preserve, because that probably would have been a brutal brawl between defense counsel, plaintiff counsel, those who have written the 14,000 records retention laws in the United States, it probably would get complicated. But Rule 37E1BI provides a uniform national standard permitting a court to impose sanctions or give an adverse inference jury instruction only on a finding that the party to be sanctioned has acted willfully or in bad faith. Luckily, the rules do not define those things. So, because this gets into the court smell test of they know it when they see it. And, you know, that raises the wonderful, you know, specter of, you know, in the early 1970s when the Supreme Court watched pornographic movies dealing with obscenity, or the more recent video game case where the justices were playing video games as part of their, you know, their analysis of the case, which I thought was kind of entertaining. So there are other standards in Rule 37 as well, and Rule 37E1BII permits sanctions in the absence of a finding of willfulness or bad faith. The above rule permits sanctions when the loss of information irreparably deprived a party of any meaningful opportunity to present or defend against the claims in the litigation. It's supposed to be a narrow rule. The court must look to all the claims or defenses in the action, such as a crippling loss of evidence justifying sanctions, if the affected claim or defense was central to the litigation. Think back to, I believe it was Morgan Stanley case, and this is 2006-2007 time frame, where, you know, it was a huge sanctions, you know, issue that, you know, came before the court and an order issued. And when they got to the warehouse and looked at everything, they realized it wasn't relevant to the case. We want to avoid that. We don't want spoliation motions taking place for something that was lost that wasn't part of the lawsuit. That doesn't seem to be a good use of judicial resources nor attorney time, and it turns into a fight about whether or not you preserved everything under the sun, instead of was it central to the litigation? Did it relate to a claim or a defense? Because that's what counts. That's what actually the lawsuit's about. So I think this is a good thing. Now let's actually break down Rule 37E, because being the civil procedure geek, I actually like looking at the rule. And I did screenshots of all these, because there's a lot here. So, if a party failed to preserve discoverable information that should have been preserved in the anticipation or conduct of litigation, the court may permit additional discovery, order curative measures, or order the party to pay the reasonable expenses, including attorney's fees, caused by the failure, and impose any sanction listed in Rule 37B2A, or give an adverse inference jury instruction, but only if the court finds that the party's actions caused substantial prejudice in the litigation and were willful or in bad faith, or irreparably deprived a party of any meaningful opportunity to present or defend the claims in the litigation. That or is important. Which one are we going to fall under, you know, in determining what you have to argue, and knowing that there's an and there. You have to show it caused substantial prejudice and it was willful or in bad faith. That's going to be the motion practice if this is enacted. So factors to be considered in assessing a party's conduct. The court should consider all relevant factors in determining whether a party failed to preserve discoverable information that should have been preserved in the anticipation or conduct of litigation, and whether the failure was willful or in bad faith. The factors include the extent to which a party was on notice that the litigation was likely and that the information would be discoverable. Two things you have to prove. And under B, the reasonableness of the party's efforts to preserve the information. C, whether the party received a request to preserve information, whether the request was clear and reasonable, and whether the person who made it and the party consulted in good faith about the scope of the preservation. D, the proportionality of the preservation efforts to any anticipated or ongoing litigation. I think that's interesting. I think that also might be whether or not collection was done in a defensible manner, whether we just did the targeted collection because we just needed specific items off of it, as opposed to mirror imaging somebody's hard drive. And that could even be a 10 terabyte SAN drive, that maybe you didn't need everything under the sun from a 10 terabyte SAN server, but you just needed the 2 gigabytes you needed as opposed to 10 terabytes. Under E, whether the party timely sought the court's guidance on any unresolved disputes about preserving discoverable information. So that's it that I have for now on the proposed rules. I encourage everybody to check them out. Read them. There's a lot there. There are great notes. There's also stuff in bankruptcy as well, if that interests you. And, you know, our participation in this process is important. I encourage everyone to go to the uscourts.gov website, search for, you know, the amendments, read them, and there's, you know, the procedure listed on being able to submit public comment, and share your thoughts with this. Help them make these decisions.
Yeah, this is a big deal. I mean, I don't mean to be over dramatic, but the future of the jury trial is at stake because the bottom line is, you know, very few cases go to trial anymore. And one of the big reasons is just the costs, many of the costs and expense associated with just trying to manage the early phases of trial. Discovery and the motion phases have gotten ugly. And, you know, there's some good stuff in here that I think will hopefully rein in some of the most egregious practices. But there's still obviously some room for improvement. So if you're an attorney or work in the law and are interested in these issues, I agree with Josh. Definitely, you know, get involved, let your voice be heard, and tell the rulemaking committees what they need to hear.
Thank you very much, Jason. Well, everyone, thank you for tuning in today. This was a longer broadcast because of the subject matter. And I appreciate all of you watching, and I want to thank NextPoint again for sponsoring today. And be sure to check out nextpoint.com for their e-discovery solutions. Thank you all, and have a wonderful day.